Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
If I was in World War II, they'd call me Spitfire.
No.
My name is Eric, and your name is Michael, and two films.
Yeah, well, unlike the usual setup.
Unlike the usual setup, we're going to do two films this time. What are those films?
Downfall and Good Night and Good Luck.
Should we talk about you and Good Night and Good Luck?
We can talk about that later.
I think it'll just make people sad.
Okay,
let's just
so
not
here's something
cover.
That I don't think we can actually do, because judging by the fact that these are both period pieces and historical pieces of fact, we're going to spoil these films.
Turns out Hitler was dead the whole time.
From the beginning.
The first film today.
Yeah, Downfall, which does not have a theme.
A big part of this is revealing Hitler, because that's going to be a huge component of the film.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people going into it, I think like just seeing how that's done. Going into the film, I'm like, all right, so who's going to play Hitler? What's he going to look like? That's going to make or break the film. Really.
Yeah.
And I think there's a couple ways you could do a reveal like that, but the way they went with is to cover the beginning of the story from sort of the perspective of people who were excited to see Hitler. So there's this moment of anticipation. I'm really curious too about how you build anticipation in a film. And one of the ways to do that is to have a room of people who are riddled with anticipation.
Yeah.
So you have all these people positioning to be secretaries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Waiting to, oh my God, we're going to meet Hitler. And so there's this kind of moment of this reveal here. And, you know, it's frozen on the door and you're kind of waiting for him to walk in. It's like, oh my God, suspense.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get away with that because it's kind of from the perspective of people who are waiting to see.
As opposed to like how everybody else, like who's been in the bunker for the past year and a half is just like, oh yeah, there's Hitler. He's pretty cool.
Yeah. If
he's
Hitler just walked by, you would be disappointed. I think the other way you could probably do it is just to start immediately with Hitler, like first scene.
Just
of the movie.
Like zoom in on his mustache and then zoom back out.
Right. Well, you got to swoop across his hair too.
Yeah.
You know,
so this is the intro to the werewolf movie, just with Hitler's face.
We've covered a lot of really uncomfortable subjects on this podcast, but in much the same vein as when we talk about blaxploitation or when I have to defend mutilation of bodies in a sexual artistic manner,
right.
I now have to talk about the portrayal of Hitler in an artistic context.
Yeah.
This is going to be fun. Portrayal of Hitler, I was totally fine with in this. I was a little skeptical going into it because they kind of try and give him a more sort of humanistic side.
Because he's a human.
Well, yeah, I know. But I was worried.
They were going to try to make you be like, Hitler wasn't all that bad.
Yeah,
kind of like
bit.
Martha Stewart meets Hitler.
Right.
Be like, Hitler's home and garden.
Right. And, you know, you want to see a human perspective, but you're still dealing with like a fascist dictator.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's difficult to do. And I think the film pulled, if I could commend this film for anything, and there's a couple of things I really want to commend it for, but that's early one of the big things. Before we come back around to the Hitler stuff, though, this is kind of, and this is going to be a little weird, but it's kind of an excuse to talk about Cloverfield a little bit. There's kind of this genre of movie, and it's weird because it's not a set genre of its own. It's like different, sort of a panicked or a war-ridden kind of template for a movie. Cloverfield's a good example. Cloverfield's a big monster movie. But there's a lot of human reaction to panic in Cloverfield. You get that, I assume, probably with films that dealt with 9/11, although I haven't seen any of them. You get that in dramas. Children of Men had that same feel to me. And these are all totally different genres. We're talking about monster movies. We're talking about historical depictions of war.
Right.
We're talking about science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
They all have the same kind of feel to them as far as that mass pandemonium and chaos. I really like seeing that portrayed on film. The first time I think this really had sort of the Cloverfield feel to it is directly after they have the little party in the beginning. Ava wants a big swing dance party.
Yeah. Right?
And then they go immediately to the underground stuff. So an easy way to capture that feel is just the sort of the Children of Men way too. The outside explosive gunfire thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing a lot of these movies seem to incorporate is various underground kind of themes. different settings. I mean, this movie, obviously, because they're in bunkers a lot. But the first time you see a lot of those shots is after that little party, and they move directly into the underground bunkers, which reminds me of like a subway or a little bit of the underground stuff in Children of Men. I think part of the reason for that is because it's a depiction of a setting you don't see too often. I don't know about you, but like, I don't spend a lot of time running around panicked in subways, fending myself off from creatures.
Yeah. Most of the time that doesn't happen.
Which is kind of ironic.
Sometimes homeless people.
Right. Right. Yeah. Which has more of a parallel with a film like 28 Weeks Later than it does Cloverfield. Right. It's funny because we're in a war, right?
Yeah.
The parallels aren't really the things that bother me so much as the things that are different. I mean, you get this idea of war when you learn about it in history or when you're a kid or whatever. And it's like the depiction of war in a film like this, when you're actually dealing with bombs and guns and chaos like that, or being forced to live underground. Mm-hmm. You know, for a movie that was set in World War II, there certainly wasn't a lot of war. You know what I mean? That was one of the stylistic choices the film made in telling its story.
It's cool that, like, I mean, with a story involving Adolf Hitler and the whole, like, end of the Third Reich, which I mean is 100% synonymous with World War II.
Right.
It's strange that the film chose World War II as a B story.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Well, it did that in a lot of different ways. You know, you look at the treatment of Jews, right? And I mean, the word Jew didn't even come up till at least 2/3 of the way through. I mean, very, very little.
And then there were only like 2 or 3 lines involving it. And I think the only reason they inserted it is because they didn't want to alienate the fact that he was proud of that, but they didn't want to dwell on it because I think they were trying to portray that, like, the whole, you know, liquidation of the Jewish population was like an afterthought
for
Hitler. He's just like
it was natural to them. It wasn't like, something
I do. He's just, and everybody's like, oh yeah, we're just killing all the Jewish people. Yeah. And Hitler's like, that's just what you do.
Right. It's like how they don't talk about their breakfasts.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Right. It's just like another part of life. Mm-hmm. It's such an afterthought.
Yeah.
And in treating it like it's an afterthought, I think it gave, you know, it wasn't the focus of the film.
Yeah.
But it gave more power to the whole idea because it was just such a calm thing
It made it seem that much like more, you know, heinous that like, not only was like Hitler just like, oh yeah, I'm just killing the Jewish people.
Yeah.
Everybody else was like, oh yeah. And then they're like, anyway,
he's just killing the Jewish people.
They're like, anyway, thanks for the ravioli.
It's weird little things like that. It's the foreign country things.
Yeah.
The things that make it seem, you know, like it's your typical day, any other day, just like today, but there happens to be like millions of innocent people that are being exterminated. And that's, to me, that's so much more.
It's darker and more real like it makes it scarier. And that's one of the few facets they give to make you realize Hitler's crazy.
Right.
I mean, they give you some obvious ones. Blatantly obvious ones, like when he starts saying that he has thousands of fighter jets and like secret armies.
Right.
Because they show this side of him that's like really human, but they don't want to like, you know, they don't want to alienate people into thinking he's a great guy and that he was just misunderstood.
Right. We don't see a lot of the war that's going on now. I mean, partially because of, you know, whatever reasons, media fatigue or whatever, the fact that it's not, you know, really being fought over here. But one of the weird kind of parallels that struck me early in the film is as soon as there's kind of this Berlin conflict, it's very early. And the film doesn't deal with the whole treatment of World War II. It deals kind of with the last days of it, which I very much liked. You kind of start off with Hitler being like the last person who believes this is still going to work. I mean, there's a few others, but it's, you know, it's kind of that Bush-Iraq thing. It's like him, his wife, and his German shepherd, you know, as long as they believe in him, that's going to be it.
Yeah.
And everyone else kind of realizes that stuff is crumbling. And it's that weird parallel, seeing the mistakes made between that. I mean, that is obviously the last of the mistakes. And, you know, wars that are still fought today, it only requires the denial of a small group of really powerful people to continue that kind of slaughter and destruction. Mm-hmm. And in this case, lead to the suicide of many others.
I mean, and I mentioned this when we were watching it. It makes you wonder what exactly there is to socialism when people just kill themselves when it goes away.
Right.
I mean, I could be wrong and maybe I'm jaded because, you know, I'm, you know, in my 20s and therefore like the government is this like nebulous evil thing regardless. Sure. So democracy isn't like something I'm willing to die for or kill for or like live for.
Well, and you're a bit of a pacifist too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's fair to say.
My point is like, I can't see even like other people that I've met with the fall of democracy, like killing themselves and their children.
No, over I mean, the worst thing we get is every time there's an election, someone goes, if so-and-so wins, I'm moving to Canada.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Like that's what happened. Yeah. And they don't either.
Yeah. Right. If everyone in Germany at the end of socialism moved to Canada, it would be a different war.
Yeah. That would make it
World
a different
War III would have happened also. And we would be fighting with Canada, America's hat.
Over logging. No. So we have this, a weird kind of passive thing here, where people, you know, they value freedom and democracy, but not so much willing to die for it.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a problem. I mean, I think that's about where you want to be at.
No, I wasn't saying it's a problem. It just makes me wonder what there is to socialism. Yeah. See, like if it were religion, I could be like, oh yeah, doctrine. Like when you lose your religion, you kill yourself. Sure. But when it comes to politics, like there's no line of politics that says if no socialism, then suicide.
Right.
It's just like this strong belief system, I guess.
And I know this is going to get crazy because we're now two libertarians wondering if there's anything to socialism.
Yeah.
But they talk a bit about the abandonment of socialism in the film and how it seems like the worst thing ever.
Yeah.
In the same way that we, we'll talk about this a bit in the next film, but we used to talk about socialism, not so much anymore, but now it's like, ooh, socialized medicine. It's a new cool European spin,
right.
You know? But we used to talk about socialism and communism as if they're different. Like they were the worst possible creations, but like they were given to us directly by Satan himself.
Yeah, well, like they were ticking time bombs in the human mind. If you're infected with socialism, the only thing is you're just counting down to explode and kill America.
Yeah, right.
And just punch a big hole in democracy.
Well, and I think that's the reason people were so willing to die to defend socialism or die as a result of, well, if I can't have socialism, I don't even want to be alive. I think it is still sort of a doctrine, much in the same way as religious doctrine, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
I think it's this kind of idea that becomes so ingrained in your head. You get this sense of this like warped sense of patriotism.
Well, like, I mean, and going back to the Jesus camp, mm-hmm. I mean, I could see those people.
Oh, sure.
Maybe not killing themselves because there's doctrine against that.
Right.
But I could see
part of dogma.
I could see a reality. Like if they were hit with the reality of, you know, being wrong, I could see them possibly killing themselves.
Well,
or,
and I think it's
worse.
Much the same thing here. I think that's probably the answer. I mean, if you evaluate socialism like on a conceptual level, if you just look at the pros and cons and how it would work in the same way that you look at the pros and cons of, say, a democracy, I think you can probably pull yourself far enough away now, especially because we're not pitted with such propaganda like you were in World War II. Where you can evaluate the two different systems and kind of see what's going on there.
Yeah.
And I would like to think I've at least used that to make a valid call that socialism is a bad idea.
Right.
But in a time of war, you get so much propaganda against the other side that socialism becomes not a political methodology, but you know, it becomes everything about you. It becomes the meals you eat and the people you love.
Right.
Socialism is like your parents and your brother and sister and your great leader. And I think that's what makes people, that's my guess anyways, is what makes people so ready to die for that.
Right.
One of the greatest examples of that whole leadership idea, I think, is when the general gets the phone call or is on the phone and he's talking about how he's supposed to be shot.
Oh, yeah.
And he's I guess I'm supposed to be shot.
How he was like, I didn't move the front lines. And they're like, yeah, you did. And he's like, I clearly did not.
But before he gets to that point, he's just like, well, I'm supposed to be shot. Better report in.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't even bother him. He's so ready to like, well, that's what the leader says, you know? And the whole time he's talking to the other soldier and he's walking down there and he's talking to the other people. I mean, he speaks to them as if it's, you know, he gets a little worked up.
Yeah.
But
he gets worked up over rank, but not over like process.
Yeah, exactly.
He gets worked up.
For him, it's like a clerical error.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, didn't you remember to cross your T's and dot your I's here?
Yeah.
What the fuck? This isn't what happened. I know that's one of the, I always hate giving into such obvious things in film because that's supposed to be one of the things that makes you go, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And it really does.
Yeah.
But it's executed in such a way that you can't help but step back and give in to that method that they've used and really just go like, man, that is fucked up.
Yeah.
And that's one of the sort of the earlier things in the film that helps you realize the mindset of these people and what's going through their head and how ready they are not only to die for their cause, but more importantly, I think to subject themselves to the power of a tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
The treatment of violence is really one of the major things that from a technical or from kind of a story aspect that I think made this film stand out. Because you're spending so much time underground and in the bunker, the few occasions that they do kind of come up for air, so to speak, you see the bombs, you know, you see the gunshots or whatever. it jars you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's the scene directly after the marriage. They have that quick little where it seems like they don't even care. It's just like, yeah, I do. All right. It's like, again, it's like a technical procedure. It's a clerical thing.
Yeah.
And they kind of come up from that. They come up to smoke sometimes, or they come up to bury the bodies or whatever. But directly after the marriage, they're showing a couple of these different explosions that are just executed so well. I feel like from not only from a story perspective, but from a technical perspective, when you only have a small handful of explosions to deliver in a film, you can probably do a lot better job on them.
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple different schools of thought. I mean, if you're doing them over and over, you probably get used to them and get more efficient and better. But I feel like in a film like this, you spend so much time in these like intense human relationships, and you come back out of that and you don't have to worry about making all of your gunfire and your explosions look really good, because there's only a few of them. Mm-hmm. And as long as they hit, I think it kind of, it brings you back into the reality that, oh yeah, it's still war.
The one thing that they avoid, which I mean, I can take or leave depending on the film. They avoid the whole, like, when an explosion goes off, somebody goes flying into the air.
Right, yeah. The Wilhelm scream.
Yeah, just like that whole thing. This film, had there been more people flying in the air, it probably would have crucified itself.
Right, yeah.
Because there's so many explosions, and they go the route of, like, shrapnel instead of, like, you know, the explosion flinging you so high that you break your back when you land on the ground. And I think it's just like the believable, like regardless of like, I mean, I'm sure that happens like once every
well,
like.
You go in a different direction, you go film like Saving Private Ryan, right? Which is a standout because of how brutal it is.
Yeah.
You know, with a film like this, I mean, the people flying through the air would have been over the top.
Yeah.
When you look at a lot of the suicides or the gunshots and stylistically, like I questioned a couple of them. So there's a couple where you get almost no blood, where they kind of cut away.
Yeah.
I mean, when you have a large amount of
there's
gunshots,
a lot behind like doors and stuff.
Yeah.
Which I think as far as like a suspense level goes, is probably like better than showing the gunshot because the door closes and then it just shows the and you just wait there.
You either wait for the scene to cut or
you wait and you're like, oh, and then you just kind of like hold your breath until you hear the gunshot.
Yeah, because you know it's coming.
Yeah.
And again, stylistically, it's one of those things where you don't want an overabundance. Mm-hmm. I think back to the scene with the soldier and the grenades. And he's like at dinner with his family.
Yeah.
And rather than show like, you know, the bloody ravaged bodies, I mean, they go with the doll. They go broken glass and a doll. When you have so many different deaths like that to deliver and you want each one to mean something, you have to kind of pick these other stylistic choices. And then you can always, you know, towards the end of the film, there's another soldier who shoots himself in the face and you get a huge squib hit on the back wall. So, I mean, you just constantly have that mix to kind of bring people back into the reality things or remind them how gory it is. Yeah. And then also to take those other stylistic choices.
They also avoid like big violent deaths of the people that you know.
Right.
And the people that end up, you know, being more violently, you know, suicide or homicide, whatever, they're usually like faces that you're not familiar with and you just kind of watch them kill themselves and you're like, wow, that was wartime violence. And then when people you know die, you're like, wow, that kind of that was sad.
Soft into the night violence.
Yeah.
So speaking of that, another weird kind of choice, and I think an excellent choice, is the absence of really any kind of score from this.
Yeah.
And I don't want to like immediately pit this against American film, but I think this is something that perhaps is more more prevalent in foreign film and that American film could kind of take a note
especially from. Especially like European film.
Yeah, yeah. You have scenes that are awkwardly silent or scenes where the score is there, but it's so subtly in the background that all it's doing is preventing it from being awkward.
Yeah.
Really.
When I saw this movie in the theater when it came out.
Wow.
So it was like, you know, that much like more intense and dark and silent.
Right.
But the scene that like really gets you when there's no sound is when Frau Goebbels is killing her kids.
Right. Yeah.
It's just dead silent and you can actually like hear the glass break in her teeth.
And there's so many of the kids too. It's just like one going. After another. Yeah. It just keeps going. Yeah. One of the only scenes that stood out to me score wise was, and again, it's mostly because of an absence, is some of the last scenes where you would have the, and this kind of goes into the end of the film, But you'd have the score that tells you the film is over.
Yeah,
you
know, the flourish.
The score that wraps up the film, or the score that has the climax. That's one of the worst ways to ruin the climax of your film, is to just overscore it. And then it feels cheesy.
Yeah, and then the main characters just say each other's names while they're crying.
Yeah, right. Well, it not only does it feel bad at the time, but I mean, that stuff ages really fast. You know, 80s score, like triumphant 80s, oh my God score. Yeah.
John Carpenter is a really good example of like score failure through time.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Good. I hope we'll get to watch some of those. But in this movie, they have the score swells, but the score is so subdued. It doesn't even matter that it's like on someone's walkie-talkie. Yeah. You know, it's barely even there. And I think really just suppression of that score is what stands out and a great choice for this.
Yeah. One more thing, as far as like contrast goes with the film, the whole time you hear about the Russian army and the Russian front coming in, and they're talked about, you know, they don't really like talk about the Russians. They just kind of talk about losing.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like synonymous.
Yeah.
And then you get the scene when Frau Jun is walking, or Frau Jung is walking through all the Russians, and they're like celebrating and dancing. And you just get this parallel from before, when they were like having their party before the windows exploded.
Yeah.
And now you have like the Russians all happy, and it's just like really strange seeing all these people that have just killed themselves. And then there's another side that's just like ecstatic. They're like, hey, everybody killed themselves. That was easy.
Right.
And so then you just have just this like thing where the Russians have won and the Germans have lost, and there's still like happiness in some parts. And like, it's this like pang of consciousness where you go, wait a second, that was Germany losing World War II. That was a good thing.
Right.
But like somehow the film makes you feel bad.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
They didn't have to lose. Like, couldn't we have just shook hands?
Yeah, it goes back to that two side thing.
Yeah.
It's really easy to be against war when you're being slaughtered.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's not so much the case of what happened here, but just to look at the film from an audience standpoint, to go, man, war is bad. But then, you know, you see everybody celebrating at the end because they're on the side of the opposition.
Yeah.
You know,
well, which I mean,
they haven't just watched the film.
For all intents and purposes, so were we.
Yeah.
We're on that side, the dancing side, after we just watched a bunch of people.
Yeah, but we've just watched a film that follows the German side.
Yeah.
And so you're feeling really sympathetic towards all of that death and violence.
Right. Let's just move on chronologically to the ensuing communist scare in the United States with Good Night and Good Luck.
This was a mostly new film for you.
Mostly new, yeah. So this is a film that I saw in theaters like around the time it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And the person that I went with fell asleep. And then I just like felt bad the whole time. So then I think we left early. But apparently we didn't leave that early because like...
You remember the ending
I remember
scene.
The thing with the TVs.
But you literally remember like nothing else from this film.
I told you what I remembered of this film.
Right.
And what I remembered was the TVs.
And the aluminum ad.
And the aluminum ad.
Right.
Right. Which, so I guess that's not really that surprising, because like coming from the film area that I came from at the time, like aluminum ads was like, yeah, that's probably about as close to violence as I'm going to get.
Right.
Here's the thing where this film automatically gets like, it gets points because it's done by George Clooney.
Uh-huh.
And like, I like George Clooney, like as
Adore.
An
You're going to go with Adore. Say Adore. Don't be afraid.
I adore George Clooney. All right. He's sexiest man of the year.
He's dreamy. That's okay.
He's a dream
I understand.
Boat. He is possibly a major league hunk.
Would you say he's Dr. McDreamy?
No, but I'll call you out on knowing more about Grey's Anatomy than I do.
Isn't that Scrubs? Actually?
No,
that is Grey's Anatomy. Wasn't he on one of the, he was a doctor on TV, right?
Who?
George Clooney.
ER.
Back in ER, that's what that
Speaking
was.
Speaking of ER.
Anyway, sorry.
Good night and good luck.
Sorry, I don't know where we're going
so,
there.
So, what was I going to say? Oh yeah, George Clooney's a dream boat. The dream master, maybe. And so I like him as an actor. Like, sure. I mean, in like fucking From Dusk Till Dawn.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
incredibly
and Spy
different
Kids.
Roles,
and
too.
Spy Kids.
Oh yeah.
And I also really like him as a director in like... Confessions of a Dangerous Mind is like one of my favorite movies ever.
It's a great film.
And I mean, this film is no exception to the George Clooney rule, which is George Clooney rules.
Wow. I don't believe I'm going to let you get away with that. Can I make you like George Clooney a little bit more here?
Scientologist?
No. No, legitimately.
Oh, okay.
So, he was definitely paid $1 for acting, $1 for directing, and $1 for writing. A total of $3 for this film.
Really?
Yep.
That's awesome.
I mean, he probably took a large part of the cuts from the profit of the film, but I always like, when film creators do that, do the prophets thing more because it's kind of like taking stock in the film.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this film is going to be good. You so know it's going to be good. You're going to make a $3 bet that this film is going to be great. And turns out it is.
Yeah.
I saw him, I think, on The Daily Show or something when he was doing PR for this, or maybe before it was even being made. But he was talking about how he thought it, he like went to school for broadcasting or something. Mm-hmm. He was talking about how he thought this was such an excellent story now because of politics, like, stifling debate.
Yeah.
Specifically with the issue of terrorism. And when you dealt with that, you know, 5 years ago or whatever, that idea that you couldn't challenge anything, that we've kind of moved away from that now.
Right.
As people get more uncomfortable with the political climate, but that idea that you couldn't challenge the government at all, or you were unpatriotic and you hated our freedoms and you didn't support, remember that? You don't support the troops.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Again, the same thing we talked about with Downfall, like, just these great parallels.
Which we also watched today.
Yeah.
So since you just mentioned Downfall, I'm going to just bring one thing up here that this film does that you rarely, if ever, get from biopics, let alone like historical biopics,
mm-hmm.
in that the film's an hour and a half long. I mean, not to like knock Downfall, because I mean, first off, German, second off, great film, but yeah, 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And I mean, it earns 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
But to do a historical biopic in an hour and a half is almost unheard of.
Yeah. It's incredible.
And like, the film is done. It's not like it's trimmed. It's not like it's rushed.
And it ends at a great point. You know, it could have continued on with,
yeah, with the last five shows.
Yeah.
But
it didn't.
It leaves it open for like a sequel.
Yeah, right. I was just going to say that. And I'm like, don't say that. And then you did. I love when that happens.
There are some really good actors in this movie.
Aside from George Clooney.
And including George Clooney.
Right, sure.
Yeah. You had Robert Downey Jr., mm-hmm. David Strathairn, Alex Borstein.
Yeah. Robert Kepper, I believe is his name, from Carnival, who was in it briefly. But
yeah.
Well, it's good to see Tommy Dolan back.
And Ray Wise.
Uh-huh.
I'm intentionally ignoring Jeff Daniels.
Why?
I don't like him.
Who is not in this film?
Joe McCarthy.
Yeah. So little funny story. I don't know if this is true or not, right? It could just be rumor, but I remember this too from, I think it was after I got this on DVD and a friend of mine was telling me about it. So George Clooney tells this story, and maybe I'm trying to remove myself so much from the hearsay here, but that when this was screened to, I should preface this with, McCarthy is not, there's not an actor playing him. It's all archive footage. Right. But test audiences reported that the actor playing him was too like over the top. Like, he overacted in the part because they didn't know it was just archive footage, which I always found humorous. But how do you feel about the decision to, and we've never really talked about this, although we've had a couple films like Contact that made heavy use of archive footage or in very distinct ways.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? Like, overcasting an actor for this, let's say this part specifically.
I think that this was like, that was the best decision that could have been made for the film, especially like, I mean, it kind of doubles back on itself when they do the report where they don't quote McCarthy and they just use like footage of him speaking to like accurately represent everything.
Right.
And I think that came back twofold when they did it for the film. They're like, we're not going to misrepresent this guy. Look how nutty he is.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't even think about that. I mean, I was thinking about it more from a perspective of who you want your protagonist or where you want your story to be.
Yeah.
You know, I thought by not even casting him, the story fell on CBS. That's where the actors were.
Yeah. I mean, that's an obvious aesthetic thing,
mm-hmm.
but I think moreover for like storyline and, continuity and like moreover just like
you can't misrepresent
credibility of the film.
Especially
when you get into biopic stuff, you always run the risk of like, for example, for sure, overacting the part, and like people just be like, that he couldn't have been that crazy.
Right,
he couldn't have actually thrown oranges at a judge.
There's a point earlier in the film, and there's a lot of different points this film makes that I really want to talk about, but there's smaller subtle points that I think are really important. And one is something Edward brings up really early in the film, which is that he's found through his own reporting that stories don't always have two equal sides.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like stories are kind of given a bad go through in the media, especially, you know, I have a lot of interest in different like kind of paranormal fields, I guess. Not that I buy into any of that stuff, but when you see it reported on the news,
mm-hmm.
that's a definite flaw of this whole two sides to the story. Take something like Sylvia Brown, right? or any of these psychics that are on the news. There was that John Hornbeck thing last year or something where he was found and the media had to report on it. And part of the range of reporting on that was reporting on Sylvia Brown and how she said he was dead, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of this myth in reporting and in just in learning in general that there's two sides to everything and that you should learn both sides. When sometimes like there's easily the one where there's more than two sides, right? There's several different facets of something that haven't been considered. And also that two sides is an immediate false dichotomy. You know, sometimes one side is just blatantly wrong. I mean, you could hear that side out, but if the media is giving equal time, it's like the evolution creationism thing, right? Like, oh, let's hear both sides. But the flaw inherent in hearing both sides is that you're giving credibility to the one side that's trying to beat out the other.
Mm-hmm.
When you take something like evolution, which is just straight out fact, and then you go, well, let's hear the side of creationism, all you're doing is introducing this fake element. You know what I mean? It's like if I just came to you and I was like, there are unicorns, let's hear both sides of this story, and you put it on TV. Like there's no reason to just let whack jobs on TV. So that was a really important thing to me. The film considers a lot of different media. Part of the film, I feel, is less about the McCarthyism thing and more about just how media reports.
Yeah.
You know, the integrity of media. And I thought to bring that idea up like so early in the game was really, really cool. As far as media reporting goes, things looked a lot different in the 50s, didn't they?
Yeah.
I don't know. How do you feel about where? Like, I don't watch a lot of news on TV. I don't think you do either.
I've seen enough.
How do you feel about where that's gone?
It's silly.
Is it possible that this is just like, I don't want to say over stylized, but is it possible that this is just, it's theatrical and so it looks like they did a better job?
No, I mean, I think part of the movie was trying to base it on the actual broadcast.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, even if it's like theatrical in like a cinematic sense, it can't be so theatrical that it's not like at least marginally accurate.
Yeah. The story's notable for a reason, right?
I think that somewhere between 1958 and 2008, so in that 50 years.
Somewhere in there?
Somewhere in
2008,
there.
2008, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
What did I say? 2008?
Yeah, I don't know why you said that.
Oh, weird.
2008.
Somewhere in that 50 years, somebody came up with the idea that you want your news reporters to like be in your living room, like hanging out with you.
Infotainment.
And not giving you news.
Yeah, right.
So there's like news reporters
it's
like-
It's the have a beer with thing, right? It goes back to our political conversation. Which podcast was that? Oh, it was the Flock of Dodos podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Where we talked about this old political idea that, you know, you pick the candidate you want to have a beer with. We've kind of done that with reporting.
And it's lame because you just get like, so here's the thing that happens with news now, especially morning news,
which was the Trojan horse for this.
So like morning news are like, haha, look, I'm drinking my orange juice right here. I didn't even wear pants today. Can you believe it? And then later on, we're going to have news reporter karaoke and we're all going to bring a funny hat.
Yeah.
It's like, it's dumb. And then they're like, oh, also in the news today, 50 million people have died.
Sometimes that doesn't even make it anymore. Yeah.
In the news today, Kevin Federline lost custody of Britney Spears. Look, this is a picture of her if she were wearing a funny hat.
It always reminds me of the South Park where they do the reporting, where they're always like, it's two things on the school channel or whatever that are shown. There's the news team, and then there's the other guy who just has like animals filmed close up with a wide angle lens with funny hats.
Yeah.
And he always wins. He always gets the ratings over the news team. No, but it's kind of that. It's that infotainment. And I think it began with morning news. Maybe that's where the problem came from. But you got to think about the demographic.
Yeah.
I think younger people, I think really just, I don't want to say younger. I think everybody under the age of 50 moved on to new media. And so it just caters to old me. And, you know, the morning stuff, I feel like.
I don't know if it was intentional that you chose 50.
no, it's an accident.
But the fact that you chose 50 means that if the news is trying to cater to an over 50 audience, they should be in black and white talking like Ed Moreau.
I'm telling you, there's a market for this.
but it's people over 50.
Well, I feel like the news just, it caters to people who are... It caters to senior citizens, I feel.
I think that the news caters to people who believe that televised news is a credible news source.
Well, are we at the point where we've given up? I mean, is there no going back?
Well, I think that we need to...
Because the news doesn't do things like it did, you know, like in this film. I mean, that's the whole kind of point is it wasn't just reporting the news. It was kind of making it. And I mean, they joked about that a little in the beginning and kind of throughout the film. But that was sort of the point is that no one was challenging the government here. And they were like, all right, we're going to step up and do that. you'll get something like, okay, great epic failure. I'm going to use that phrase, epic failure of the media, if there ever was one in my whole life. You remember the Danish cartoons that came out? The cartoons of Muhammad? All right, so we have this religious rule. If you're in the Muslim club, as if there's an atheist club we're in and there's a Christian club. If you're in the Muslim club, one of their club rules, like Freemason style club rules, is that you can't have a picture of Muhammad. You can't have a cartoon depiction.
Yeah.
And if you're in that club and you play by those rules, that's fine. And I make the Freemason reference because it's like the ring thing.
Yeah.
There's a Freemason ring and you're not allowed to wear it unless you're a Freemason. But those rules only apply to Freemasons. So you and I can wear a Freemason ring because we don't care about the rules of the Freemason club.
Exactly.
In much the same vein, you have the cartoons of Muhammad, which are blasphemous if you're Muslim. Mm-hmm. They're not blasphemous to us.
They're not blasphemous to who made them for them.
Right. And they're newsworthy. So we had these Danish cartoons and everyone in America was afraid to air these. I mean, it became, let's talk about this controversy, but you couldn't find the cartoon. You could find them on the internet because the internet is free and open and like saved the world, but you couldn't get them on TV. It was this failure that reached so ridiculously far. You know, Skeptical Inquirer was one of the few magazines in America to even publish the cartoons.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't stock them at bookstores. They wouldn't stock the issue because of this idea of fear. Like it was a failure, not only I feel of reporting, but it was a joke because that was the whole idea.
Yeah.
Don't let the terrorists win. Yeah. That was like the slogan, right? That was like America's little catchphrase. And then it was like, we were literally being terrorized in the most stereotypical example where someone was like, here's a cartoon. Don't show it or I'll bomb your building. And we were like, well, don't let the terrorists win. Oh, also let's not show this cartoon. And so the news media just totally, and they talked about it. They talked about it in that false dichotomy way. They're like, well, we're going to remain neutral, but there is no neutral ground here. It's binary. You show it or you don't. Yeah. And so by remaining neutral, they didn't show it.
Yeah.
All of American news. that's when I feel if I had to pick a moment where old media being TV and new media being YouTube, I guess, the internet podcasts, internet news sources.
What?
Where, where old media failed and died. It was that day, I think.
Yeah.
Because that was the moment where it became such a joke where like, if you didn't, it's like not understanding satire.
Right.
Like if you didn't see the joke, you were so past the point of failure that there was no turning back. I feel that's when it was. That or morning news.
Probably a little bit of both.
It could have been either.
Maybe that one, the one time Muhammad appeared on morning news.
Right. Right. That could have been the day.
Yeah.
I mean, has the news media done anything right in our lifetime?
The ABC station on State Street in the Loop is really cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The zombie march this summer. If zombies had taken over new media in Chicago instead of taking over the ABC news station, you know, there's that. Yeah. And there's stations outside. So, hey, that's kind of cool. You can look in the window.
Yeah.
Seriously, though. So you have the Katrina stuff. I mean, the news media was kind of praised for like the reporting of Katrina, which I don't want to hand them too much of an easy piece there because it's like it was an obvious fuck up and really sad. So it's like that wasn't a surprise to me.
Yeah.
But you look at like the aftermath of 9/11.
Yeah.
And like that was a weird time to be reporting, I guess. But even in the months following that, they attach themselves to these slogans. I think it's just been an all-around failure. I can't wait for the day that old media just disappears.
That's coming up, especially with the cancellation of network programming at the end of the year.
Right. Well, and all science and news. I mean, science has been completely removed from news.
Is incredible. Like, you can't credit science.
Yeah, right. Incredible? Is that?
Incredible.
All right. Yeah, you get that on the internet. I think that's how it's going to happen. Uh-huh. I think small pieces of news are just going to keep getting removed. You'll start with science and maybe health or something until it's just sports. Sports will probably go too because it's easier to get scores online.
Yeah.
So it'll just be stories about hip replacement.
How fat America's getting.
Yeah, right. It'll just be stories about how fat America's getting and global warming.
And what causes cancer this week. Right. And food scares.
And that'll be it. And then it'll move. So you think there's no saving it? I mean, do we just make the transition to new media?
So I suppose there is definitely methods of saving it. The matter is whether or not it's worth it.
Right.
And the answer is no.
Do you think that's it?
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to ask you. So yeah, if it's worth saving, I feel like TV is just going to go digital anyways, and we're going to eliminate that eventually. So I'm not too worried about it. But one thing I am kind of concerned with is if old media is going to creep into new media. they're starting to do that now. If you go to any of the big stations' websites, they have video content and viral stuff and a little like dig button.
Yeah.
We also have a dig button. Please go click that.
Click the dig button.
Don't click ABC News's dig button. Is there a threat that like old media is going to like just transform into new media and we're still going to have
it? Dude, no, we're not going to let old media win.
Are you sure about that?
We're not letting old media win.
You have stock in podcasts, so I don't know if I trust your opinion.
We're not going to let old media win.
You can't just believe what people on podcasts say because they're jaded.
What's a podcast?
On the lighter side of news, I wanted to go out on the titular line here. Because this is a big titular line film.
Multiple titular lines.
And it's delivered in the way that a titular line would usually be cheesy. So I definitely have feelings about the titular line here, but I wanted to know how you... Well, again, if you've never listened to any of our other podcasts, yeah, because it's covered almost every show.
Pretty much.
Titular line would be the title line when someone says good night and good luck.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the thing is I think that especially in the case of historical pictures and, you know, the whole thing with Ed Moreau being real.
Yeah, right.
The movie was probably named before the film was written.
Yeah, I could see that.
I mean, Ed Moreau clearly...
It's his tagline.
Yeah, like that's his thing. So, I mean, it's the same thing as like when they named Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Right.
Like that was named before the film was written.
Do you think that's kind of a fault of the film or does it work here?
Okay, so...
I mean, when I say a fault of the film, I mean knowing that the title is where I think a fault would come in. Knowing that the title is Good Night and Good Luck. Did it make you feel differently through the film or make the scenes where he said good night and good luck? Like, did it feel campy? Did it feel...
I thought that the title was wasted, but I didn't think that it was poorly... I didn't think it was poorly done. I think there are two ways to name a movie. There's a way to name a movie where the name helps the movie.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a way where you waste it. Those are the only two good ways.
Right.
I'm saying wasting the title and the term waste automatically makes people think that's negative.
Right.
But wasting the title is essentially titling the movie something that does not influence your view of the film in any way. But then you have movies where they like name it something and it's terrible. Like Chasing Amy.
Which has a titular line as well. The worst titular line.
Dude, you're chasing Amy.
I feel like, so I'm always worried that you're going to do the kind of thing that, Scanner Darkly is a good example of this because they have the sort of titular line thing in it. And I always have to think about it when it happens. I always have to kind of laugh to myself and I've gotten over that and I think I'm okay with it, especially being that it's from a book and stuff and whatever. Yeah. There's excuses. But I'm always concerned that the title will affect the movie negatively when you hear the line.
Yeah.
You know, like your impression of, it's kind of like if you listen to this podcast and we like reveal a particular scene of a movie, when you go through and watch that movie, like without failure, you're going to go, oh yeah, this is the scene that I listened to on the podcast or that more commonly my friends told me about, you know, be like, oh yeah, this is that scene. And it kind of affects your viewing.
Right.
And that's like the main reason I don't like titular lines outside of the fact that they usually just fail.
Yeah.
In this film, I think they kind of got around the awkward feeling because those were kind of key moments in the film. They kind of segmented the film into certain chapters. That and, you know, it was always the sign off. It was like the end of this era of the film, this kind of little storyline sort of wrapped up here. We're moving on to the next phase. And they always, you know, you always saw the lights dim off his face, which I liked.
Yeah.
I mean, your transition, we talked about that in, I believe it was the Freddy movies, where the ways you can get around like bad kid dialogue or bad delivery with cuts. And I felt like this was kind of one of the, not that this was bad delivery or dialogue, but when you're delivering a titular line and it's making people think specifically about it, the way you get around that line or exit that scene is important.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked that, you know, you would see the camera light come off his face.
Yeah.
And it would kind of remind you that this was a broadcast and that's over now. You would see kind of his reaction, the aftermath going through his head of the broadcast and then the lights go off. And I really like that.
Right.
All right. So we have a MySpace and a Facebook page.
Yep.
You can get to both of those through our website, which is doublefeatureshow.com. You can contact us on the site too, or if you want to send us an email, it's doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. So yeah, give us some feedback. Let us know if we fuck something up on the show, or if you think our show is retarded, or if you're offended when I say the word retarded. Also, if you have iTunes, go to our page on the iTunes store and give us some feedback there. All right, so I think we have two movies next time.
Yeah.
You know what? Let's do movies that have nothing to do with each other.
All right. Well, I'm just going to pick off the top of my head, I don't know, Steal This Film 2.
Okay.
I'm just going to go for the sequel.
All right.
And let's do Freddy versus Jason.
Oh, I have not seen that.
You have not seen that. And you earned it.
I did earn it. We didn't quite give me the pat on the back we did the first time with the Freddy movies, but I sat through so many of those fucking movies.
Yeah. Also, I'm just going to plug this now.
Yeah.
Halloween is going to be the next one.
Yeah. All right.
So anybody who's
you want to do Halloween next? Because I was thinking Texas Chainsaw.
You want to do
next.
Texas Chainsaw next?
I kind of want to get it out of the way.
All right. We'll
I
do Texas
Halloween,
Chainsaw.
I'm
going
to end in some Rob Zombie goodness.
Is that what you want to do? The Rob Zombie one with the Halloween?
Yeah, I think I do.
Okay.
One of the 12 cuts I haven't seen.
Okay,
there's
cool.
What, four? Right.
There's four.
And then so we'll do
Texas Chainsaw.
Texas Chainsaw next.
Okay. So
what does that include? By the way,
good. I'm glad you asked. The Texas Chainsaw series includes the Texas Chainsaw Massacre from 1974, the sequel with Dennis Hopper, then Leatherface, which is the third one.
Okay.
Then Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, which I guarantee will be the most difficult one to find for anybody who's like trying to like keep up with this. It's the one with Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger.
Okay.
Then we're going to do the terrible remake with Jessica Biel and then the more terrible prequel to the remake.
When you do your grand epic slasher series, can you just number them for me? Because I'm really getting tired of this bullshit naming scheme. Where you have like 10 movies in a series and none of them, it doesn't make any fucking sense. Like, I understand like, haha, that's kind of like what you do.
Halloween just goes straight numerically.
Really?
Until H2O.
H2O. All right. I guess I'm all right with that. So we'll do all the Texas Chainsaw movies next.
Yes.
But next week we'll do Freddy versus Jason and Steal This Film 2. I don't have Steal This Film 1 because it was really hard in my eyes to watch. They used an editing technique to like put subliminal messages in the film or something. And it just, it hurts my brain.
All right.
But Steal This Film too, like it'll give us an excuse to talk about a lot of those concepts. And
great.
For people who watch a lot of digital films, that's probably something we should talk about.
And Freddy versus Jason is a film where Freddy actually versus Jason.
Good.
Okay.
So you have a lot of films to watch. Get busy on that.
I believe what you mean to say is watch more fucking film.
Bye. Give me a little chatter in your mic there. Wow, that really is chatter.